You're listening to the FQXI podcast. You can also read a winning entry from last year's FQXI essay contest. That was the one that asked whether reality was digital or analogue, by David Tong in the December issue of Scientific American. The essay contest was certainly a highlight of 2012 for us, but what other physics stories hit the headlines over the past 12 months? Since the end of the year beckons, I invited FQXI member Ian Durham, a quantum physicist at St. Alnson's College, New Hampshire, and another of this year's essay contest winners, to run through what he thinks have been the top four foundational physics highlights of 2012. First of all, congratulations, Ian Durham, on your award-winning FQXI essay.
All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It was a pleasant surprise. Nice Christmas present, actually.
And thank you for talking to us today and running through your sort of highlights from the world of foundational physics in 2012.
My pleasure. I'm on sabbatical this semester, so it's always nice to actually talk to someone.
So your fourth story, your fourth pick of the year, it's quite abstract, it's quite theoretical, and it's to do with the foundations of quantum mechanics. So can you explain a little bit about what you've chosen?
Sure. I've chosen a paper by Matt Pusey, John Barrett, and Terry Rudolph that's been known since they put it out as the PBR paper, due to their last names. And it has the rather strange title that the quantum state cannot be interpreted statistically. And I should probably give a little background, because this is kind of technical and a little out there. But quantum states, so when we have physical systems, we usually describe them as being in a particular state. And the quantum state has been debated for, well, quite nearly 100 years now, not quite, but almost, about what it is. It, specifically, a quantum state is described by something called a wave function.
So this is trying to get to this sort of this central point of quantum mechanics, which is that, you know, before you measure a system, you don't really know what state it's in, and it's not really even in a set state. It's in sort of a superposition of different states. And the wave function is kind of a mathematical description of the probability of finding it in some kind of state. Is that a way to put it?
That's one way to put it. I think there's debate about that, and that's kind of what this paper's a little bit about. The wave function is the mathematical description both before and after measurement. So the question is what is the wave function? What is the quantum state? The two words that tend to be used are epistemic and ontic. So epistemic would mean that it's a state of knowledge, whereas ontic means that it's a state of reality. And Matt Leifer, who's another FQXI member and who has a really nice blog, mattleifer.info, he sort of described three different camps of belief in the wave function. There are those who think that it's epistemic, meaning that the wave function describes a state of knowledge. It's what we know about the system. It doesn't necessarily describe reality. But that then there is some underlying reality beneath it. There is an underlying ontic state. So there's an ontic state, and then the wave function is the epistemic state on top of that. That's one camp. Then there are those people who are pure epistemists. They say the quantum state is the epistemic state, and that's it. There's no underlying reality in the sense that if a tree falls in the quantum forest and no one's there to hear it, these guys would say the quantum forest doesn't even exist. Unless someone is there to make a measurement, the thing doesn't exist. So, and I actually have had serious people who've said this to me at various times where they say, oh, sure, you know, because I would say that to them, I'd say, well, does that mean that things like the newly discovered Earth-massed planet around Alpha Centauri, does that mean that it didn't exist until we looked at it? And I had a very serious physicist, quantum physicist, who has a respectable, non-crazy guy say, yes, that is exactly what it means. So that's the second group of people. They really don't believe anything exists until you look at it. That's sort of a neo-Copenhagen kind of interpretation. That's kind of what Niels Bohr was aiming for originally. Then there are the third people that say the wave functions are ontic. They're states of reality. So a wave function is a real thing. And I would guess that most field theorists probably fall in this category. So your particle physicists and your field theorists, people who believe that fields, those who believe that those things are real, actual things, and that it's not just information, those are the folks who fall into that category. So those are the sort of the three options. So the PBR paper, though, essentially tries to rule out camp number one and says that if you believe that there is some underlying ontic state, then you really ought to believe that wave functions are ontic to begin with. In other words, if you believe that there is some underlying reality, then you ought to believe that the wave function itself is reality and is not just statistical.
Does everybody just agree with this now, or is this still up for debate? Is this still controversial?
There is definitely some debate about this. And in fact, I think the PBR paper really only rules out what you would say is realist competitions to certain types of ontic models. So the ontic approaches, the ones that believe there really isn't underlying reality, include the many worlds interpretation or the Everett interpretation that says that, you know, there are lots of worlds constantly being formed. Basically, it takes the wave function literally. And then there's de Broglie-Bohm theory with its pilot waves. And then spontaneous collapse models. And those are sort of some semi-realistic or semi-ontic kind of models. And so the PBR result kind of rules out realist competitors to those theories.
Does this paper have any practical implications, or is this something that's really purely theoretical? Or, you know, would this make any difference to things that we could build in the future or experiments we could do?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. And my gut reaction is to say, nah, this doesn't have anything to do with practical results. But I also happen to be an engineer, and thinking long and hard about this down the road, I think it does have some important implications for practical technology, assuming humanity doesn't obliterate itself before it reaches that point. But I think the people who are in camp number one, the ones who believe it's a state of knowledge but are looking for hidden ontologies, the whole question is whether or not they should even be doing that to begin with. Because is it really just philosophy or not? And because you never know what kind of technologies will come out of these fundamental physical problems. I mean, nobody thought quantum mechanics was terribly useful when it first came out. And here it is. It's used every day in all sorts of things. So the question is if we don't look for hidden ontologies, and will we necessarily miss something that could give us something practical down the road? And so I think in that sense, the PBR paper is important because it does imply that there are certain approaches that probably shouldn't be taken, or shows that they can't really be taken.
Well, talking about the practical applications of quantum phenomena, I think that's leading us towards your number three top story of 2012. So please tell us what that is.
Indeed. So that's the Nobel Prize in Physics this year, which surprisingly, not totally surprisingly, but a little, it surprised some of the people who predict these sorts of things, went to Serge Haroche and Dave Wineland for actually figuring out a way to manipulate individual quantum particles. Way back in the founding of quantum mechanics, I believe it was Schrödinger who said that no such thing was even possible. In fact, I have a quote. Schrödinger said, in the first place, it is fair to state that we are not experimenting with single particles any more than we can raise ichthyosauria in the zoo. Schrödinger wrote that in 1952. Because I think people really believed it was a statistical theory, and that on an experimental level, we couldn't actually manipulate individual particles, like a single electron or a single photon. But Haroche and Wineland have, using slightly different methods, been able to do that. And what that has helped pave the way for is practical applications of quantum computing in particular, where we can actually individually manipulate single quanta so that we can use them as bits or qubits instead of classical bits. In particular, the details of it is that Dave Wineland, he does a lot of work with ion traps. And what they do is, using lasers, they take an ion, which is basically an atom that has electrons stripped off of it. So it has a net positive charge. And they basically shine a lot of lasers on it from a lot of different directions and get it to pretty much stay still so that you can then move it around. You can change the spin and do other things to it to change the state. And Serge Haroche has done similar things, but he sort of approached it from a slightly different standpoint. He was doing a lot of work with photons and, in fact, was part of a team that realized the first two-photon micromaser. So a maser is like a laser, but in microwaves. And just to give you an idea, it's very hard to isolate a microwave photon because you're starting to get into longer wavelengths. A photon is a naturally localized particle. Well, when you get into microwave, you're starting to get into things with long wavelengths where it's kind of hard to say it's actually localized. And what Serge Haroche's team has done was essentially develop microwave cavities and has performed similar tasks to what Dave's group has done, but using what's called cavity QED. So it's a slightly different way of looking at the similar kind of problem.
Now, you mentioned that it was sort of a surprise to some of the people that were trying to predict what was going to win the Nobel Prize in Physics this year. Is it just because, like you sort of said, people didn't expect that experimenters would be able to actually manipulate these states? Or is it also that, you wouldn't perhaps have expected this particular discipline to be recognized at this point in time?
I think it's the latter. Although Thomson Reuters, there's a guy who works for Thomson Reuters who sort of makes a business of predicting these things and actually doesn't always get it right in the particular year. He does have a fairly good track record of long-term predictions. So if he predicts you're going to win one year, you usually end up winning down the road at some point. But he did predict it would be somebody from the Quantum Foundation's quantum information community. He had predicted Charlie Bennett, Gilles Brossard, and Bill Wooters.
Just to clarify that the prediction that you were talking about for sort of Bennett and co was for their work on quantum teleportation.
Yes, and I was personally rooting for them because I know Charlie and Bill, and I just spent some time with Bill this summer, and Bill works at a small liberal arts college like I do, so it would be neat to have somebody on that level win. But I have to say, since I work in quantum information in addition to foundations, we were quite elated because it's the first Nobel Prize that specifically, not in the official citation, but somewhere in the write-up, the Nobel Committee actually mentioned quantum computing. So I think that's what was surprising, especially with certainly the pundits were expecting the Higgs to win this year.
Right now, we come into your number two big story of the year, which you've already kind of touched on, and I think it might be surprising to people what number two is here. So go ahead.
It's the Higgs.
It's the Higgs.
I felt, we had to put the Higgs in there somewhere. So, of course, last year, late last year, 2011, there were some results that came out of the LHC that suggested that they perhaps had found evidence of the Higgs. It was funny, last year at this time, when they had the initial results, I believe they were correct to within, was it 3 sigma or 5 sigma, something like that. And the biologists all laughed and said, well, geez, that's dead on correct when if you're a biologist. And of course, the particle physicists said, yeah, but 50% of the time in particle physics, a result like that is wrong. So they had to do some additional work, which was done. And this summer, they released some additional data that supposedly confirms that the Higgs exists. And, there's still some additional work that needs to be done to really nail it down. But I think it's pretty evident that, yes, the Higgs does exist. I will say there are some funny things. It was a little anticlimactic. Physicists really like it when new physics comes about, and people thought, well, wouldn't it be great if the Higgs didn't exist? The Higgs existing is essentially confirmation of the standard model of particle physics. When we make discoveries that merely confirm previous models, sometimes it's a little ho-hum. Now, what's very interesting, there are two things I wanted to mention in relation to this, because I have a psychologist friend who finds this whole concept rather amusing that we have these reams and reams of data that, you have to manipulate it and move it around just in the right way in order to tease out this little bit of data that says, oh yeah, there's actually a particle there. And he says, wow, that's just weird on so many psychological levels. And I said that it confirmed the standard model. Well, what's interesting is along with the standard model, they've long believed in this thing called supersymmetry, which postulates that there are these supersymmetric particles that are coupled with actual real particles. And a lot of people thought, well, maybe that's dark matter. Well, recent results, like really recent results within the last few weeks, have come out to say that, yeah, there's a problem with supersymmetry. They have not been able to confirm something that they expected. And that, to a lot of people, puts everything back at ground zero. The other sort of tangential big news that goes along with that this year was the false neutrino results.
Oh, yes, yes, the neutrino, the faster-than-light neutrino.
I had two things to say about that. So this goes back to my psychologist friend's comment about how he thinks, you know, all of these high energy physics results are very interesting because we're making a lot of logical deductions, a whole string of logical deductions from some very fuzzy data. And in the neutrino results, I guess it was a problem with the GPS receiver or something, that the time was wrong. But the thing is, it underscores how delicate and how tremendously complicated some of these high-energy physics experiments are, and how difficult it is to make some of these measurements, and why it's so important to make sure you absolutely have it right. And I will say that there are some new results coming out of the condensed matter physics community where they're able to repeat some of the experiments or even do new experiments that the particle physicists would need billions of dollars to do, and these guys can do it on a desktop lab. And I think maybe that's perhaps where some of the future in this sort of thing lies. I suspect there are fewer things that could go wrong. And I think the problem with some of these huge things like the LHC is that one little thing goes wrong and did you find the Higgs or did you find a flea that got into your system? I mean, you don't know. You never know. So
with these sort of condensed matter tabletop experiments that you're describing there, would they be able to address the same kind of big questions in physics? And if so, would it be a case of trying to model systems or simulate them in a way, but not actually to kind of recreate events that we saw in the early universe? Or what exactly can these condensed matter experiments do?
Well, the one thing that comes to mind is related to some work that I've been doing lately, and that's there are these things that were predicted a long time ago called Majorana particles, and they are particles that are their own antiparticles. And Majorana particles have been theorized for a long time. A lot of people think maybe neutrinos might be Majorana particles, but there are some problems with that because there are some other results about neutrinos that are intriguing that suggest that maybe they're not. But some guys in condensed matter have been able to create what I would call quasi-Majorana particles. It's not just modeling them, it's actually making them. They're not fundamental particles. What they've done is they've taken an electron and they've managed to split it into two different parts, its inherent spin part and its orbital part. That's kind of weird. And in that way, it's sort of a Majorana particle in a sense. And in fact, a paper I'm working on right now would suggest that, yes, that qualifies as a Majorana particle, but it's not a fundamental Majorana particle, I guess. But I think that offers some suggestions about how it might be possible to use condensed matter physics to do things that normally might be done by a huge accelerator. I mean, these guys created this thing in a wire. Certainly, it's very sophisticated equipment, but it's not the size of the LHC and certainly is a lot cheaper. Now, could we explore the early universe this way? I don't know. I was about to say no, but you never know, because there were people who suspected you needed a big accelerator or a collider to make Majorana particles. But, you know, I think there are some very interesting things that'll come out in the coming years from condensed matter physics that might turn particle physics on its head.
So now, you know, the researchers behind the Higgs discovery might feel bad that they haven't won the Nobel Prize in physics this year. And they might feel bad that they didn't make number one on your list this year. But somebody has recognized them, and that is Yuri Milner, who has been giving out lots and lots of money this year to physics, which is great. Do you want to talk a bit about the Milner Prizes?
Sure. Hey, Yuri, I could use some money. Anyway, so Yuri Milner is an internet entrepreneur from Russia who started a prize for foundational work in physics. I guess it's my understanding that apparently he had majored in physics as an undergraduate or something like that, and he made gobs and gobs of money. And he started a prize this summer to be awarded to people. I don't really know exactly who chose the original ones. I do know that in the future, anyone can nominate someone for the Milner Prize, which I think is interesting because the Nobel Prize, there are very specific limitations on who can actually make nominations for the Nobel Prize. And the interesting thing is each award of the Milner Prize is $3 million, which is more than double the Nobel Prize is. So certainly from a monetary standpoint, of course, not everything's about money, but it's big. It's a lot of money. And just to give you an idea, he's given out more than 10 awards just this year already. So he's given out $30 million to fundamental physics in a little over 6 months. And the LHC guys did receive one. It was people actually working on three different groups at the LHC, that group and then Stephen Hawking. And so the Higgs guys won something. And I'm sure $3 million is a nice amount of money right around Christmas. So,
well, you know, here's a question about, you know, sort of giving out these large amounts of money. And, you know, we should say, you know, we absolutely love the people that have been given the awards so far. It's right up FQXI's alley in terms of research into theoretical physics and the foundations of physics. But the question is, if you're going to give out lots of money, is it, you know, the best thing to do to give it out to people who are already really established, who already have really big reputations and have done a lot of good work? You know, it's sort of, I guess, a reward for what they've done. Or should the money be being invested into sort of younger people, perhaps doing new work?
That's an excellent question. And it's tough to take a stance on that. On the one hand, as someone who toils on the front lines every day, and professors don't get paid a whole lot, and there's not a whole lot of money out there for funding research in foundations. That's partly what FQXI is there to help with. It would be nice if there was some money that was put towards funding research. On the other hand, I think it's great publicity in the sense that you've got a guy who is a internet entrepreneur who is recognizing the importance of fundamental physics. This is a little bit like Lazaridis when he started the Perimeter Institute, who, you know, he made his money on the BlackBerry. RIM, Research in Motion, is the company, and recognized the importance of fundamental physics research and said, you know, let's start an institute, put some money into this.
So I guess now, you know, the question is, who gets the Ian Durham Prize for the number one physics story of 2012?
So this is going to be a surprise to a lot of people. So I awarded my top story of 2012 to the recent discovery of an Earth-massed planet around Alpha Centauri. That's an odd one for someone like me who's a quantum foundations guy. But as soon as the announcement came out, I said to myself, gee, I wonder if I could make a spaceship and go there. What's just amazing about this discovery is that, so Alpha Centauri is part of a star system that is the closest star system to the sun. It's not actually the closest star. The closest star is Proxima Centauri, which is in the same system. So that you've got a bunch of stars there all kind of hanging out together. Alpha Centauri is, you know, visible to the naked eye. It's the closest star system to us. It's only 4 light years away. And to find an Earth massed planet orbiting Alpha Centauri was just like, wow. To find one so close, wow, that's just amazing. To think it's almost within reach, almost within reach. I mean, it would take probably 40,000 years to get something there, but it's so tantalizingly close. It apparently is not in the habitable zone. It's too hot. So, you know, any plans for colonization are probably gone. But it was so inspiring that I had a number of friends on Facebook who are not scientists who just, they saw this and they were inspired. They said, let's send a probe tomorrow, you know, that kind of thing. And we probably could, you know, reach out. And like I said, it would take a very, very long time. It would require a lot of long-term thinking. Using present technology would take probably 40,000 years to get there. But, you know, for those of us who've been alive long enough to say that Voyager 1 has been out there almost my entire life, and I'm pushing middle age, we know that we can have these long-term scientific experiments in space and that they can produce really interesting and fascinating science. So it's not too far-fetched to think we could send something there, but it's tantalizing. And it really makes you wonder, geez, maybe we will get signals from another civilization. Now, speaking of really amazingly precise experiments, this required amazingly precise observations. So while experimental physicists design experiments that do something, astronomers can't do that. The best they can do is just look up and see what's there. So what they have to do is they just have to look really, really closely and carefully. But interestingly enough, the results really are similarly statistical in the sense that they're looking for very tiny little wobbles in data or light. There are lots of different ways they can find extrasolar planets, but all of them are tremendously exact measurements. I mean, it just has to be perfect in order to get that. I mean, you think about the Earth in relation to the Sun. It's 100 Earths would fit across the diameter of the Sun, I believe. That's massive compared to the Earth. So an Earth-massed planet near Alpha Centauri, which, it's a star, so it's fairly large, to find that is incredible. I mean, that's just an incredible achievement. So that's my number one 2012 thing, is the discovery of the planet around Alpha Centauri, where I wouldn't mind going on vacation. Maybe Yuri Milner will spend some money and send me there.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ian. And I guess we'll talk to you again maybe this time next year for your update on the best physics stories of 2013. And in the meantime, you can build your spacecraft.
That's assuming we'll be here because, the Mayan apocalypse is supposed to happen in about a week. So I tend not to believe in these sorts of things. But then when Hostess went out of business and I said, oh, wow, well, the Twinkie was supposed to survive the apocalypse. And now the Twinkies are gone. Maybe the apocalypse really is coming. So I don't know. Maybe the this will be the one and only Ian Durham physics stories of the year. This could be the only time it happens.
And if the world does end in, in a couple of weeks, I think that would have to take number one place, really, possibly ahead of a discovery of the exoplanet.
How would we know if the world did end? We'd all be dead.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. Okay, on that scary note, thank you very much, Ian Durham, and goodbye. So there we have it. The discovery of a home from home, practically in our own backyard, makes the top of Ian's list. Congratulations to the team of astronomers behind the discovery. You can read more about all of the items in the countdown through links on our podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.